Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with Katie Kiefer. That's me, your host. Today we're going to be talking about antibiotics in the food system yet again. I know for some of you this is like my go-to subject, but actually there is nothing more important to talk about in terms of public health. So today we're going to be, my guest is Avinash Kaur. He is an attorney with the National Resources Defense Council. Avinash is, he's the attorney with the Health and Environmental Program at NRDC. He works on antibiotics in livestock, toxic air pollution, toxics in food and consumer products. Oh, we have lots to talk about there. And reducing pollution and improving efficiency in the textile supply chain in Bangladesh. Avinash previously worked at the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment, an environmental justice organization focusing on CAFOs and air pollution in California's Central Valley, and on AB 32. I imagine that's a piece of legislation. And while at CRPE, he also served on the Environmental Justice Advisory Committee, advising the California Air Resources Board on the implementation of AB 32, California's landmark global warming law. Avinash received his JD from UC Hastings College of the Law and his undergraduate degree from Williams College. Welcome to the program, Avi. Thanks so much for joining me today. I'm really excited about the program.
Thank you, Katie. I'm delighted to be on.
Okay, great. That's fabulous. On Saturday, the New York Times published an editorial, praising the FDA for finally coming out with guidances number 209 and 213. And I wondered if we could start the program with just you giving an overview of what those guidances are and what they mean.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. A little background may be useful here. About 80% of all antibiotics sold in the U.S. are for use on cows, pigs, poultry, and other farm animals. Scientists widely agree that the misuse of antibiotics in animals is contributing to the rise of antibiotic resistance in our world, and that this increase of resistance threatens human health. So, when we become sick from infections caused by antibiotic-resistant bacteria, the antibiotics are less likely to work, leading to longer illnesses, more hospitalizations, use of medicines with greater side effects, and sometimes even death when treatments fail. So that's the context in which we are operating.
Absolutely. And okay.
Human use is also a part of the problem, but with antibiotic sales for farm animals being so large, we can't address the overall problem unless we also address the use of antibiotics in farm animals.
I'm going to stop you for a sec because your sound quality is really bad.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Where are you?
I'm on a headset. Is that the problem, perhaps?
I think that might be the problem because there's like a lot of sort of echo and ambient noise.
Okay.
Can we change that? Sorry. Sorry, everybody.
No worries. That's totally fine.
Let me see if... just doesn't sound good.
Let me just try without the headset. Is that any better?
Yes.
Okay.
Much.
Well, I'll
Thank
hold
you.
The headset.
Okay. Sorry about that. But, okay. So go
sorry
on.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
So, as I was saying, scientists widely agree that use of antibiotics in animals is contributing to a health threat to humans.
Mm-hmm.
And human use is also a part of the problem, but with antibiotic sales for farm animals being so large, we have to address that as well in order to address the problem. And this is where the FDA comes in. After many years of doing very little,
right.
The FDA has made a couple of very modest moves in the recent past. That's the guidances you referred to.
That's right. Guidances number 209 and 213, which listeners can access on the FDA website. Very easy to read them. They're not long. They're very easy to read. There's nothing mysterious about them at all.
That's right. And the gist of this audience of these guidances is that they recommend that drug manufacturers volunteer to give up labels on the antibiotics they sell that allow the use of these antibiotics for speeding up animal growth. Mm-hmm. However, these guidances continue to endorse the very similar use of antibiotics to compensate for crowded and dirty conditions.
Right. And also, let's point out that why this is in the news again is because 25 of the 26 drug companies that produce these drugs that are used in animal medicine have agreed to relabel their drugs so that they are no longer sold for growth promotion. They are only sold for disease prevention. Am I accurate there?
You're absolutely accurate. So basically that means they can continue to use these antibiotics to compensate for the conditions. And mind you, FDA is very clear that these animals are not sick. So that label, that disease prevention label, won't go away. And our concern is that what this will mean is antibiotic use in animals that are not sick will continue, but just under a different name. The label will change, but the use will not.
Right. So what is the difference between guidances and regulations?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Guidances are recommendations. They're not binding. There's no legal consequences that flow directly from a failure to abide by the recommendations. Regulations, on the other hand, are binding. Failure to comply is a violation of law.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, the companies you mentioned, the 25 of the 26 companies volunteer to go along with FDA's guidance. FDA has said it'll take about 3 years to implement the guidance.
Right.
Nothing binds the companies to stick with the plan during those 3 years.
Right.
They could change their mind at any point until the label change is made final through regulation. Of course, that's not to say they will change their mind, but they could.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So now, to go back to this editorial, which I'm sure a lot of people saw on Saturday in the New York Times, it praised the drug companies for taking this step in relabeling their drugs and agreeing to remove growth promotion as one of the purposes for which their drugs can be used. But why does the New York Times and even Pew Center feel that this is such a big step in the right direction, and why does NRDC disagree?
I was really surprised by Pew. Disagreement. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I was really surprised that Pew came out and said, oh, yeah, this is a great first step. I mean, I completely disagree with that, and NRDC apparently does as well. So why do you guys disagree?
Yeah, so I think there's probably less disagreement here than might appear, because I think this is mostly a matter of emphasis. Pew has said, for instance, that there's a lot more that needs to be done, and we agree. The New York Times is right that FDA's actions are a modest step in the right direction. After a very long time of doing very little, FDA is starting to do something, however small. So people do see that as encouraging. However, from our perspective, this step fails a very core test. It is unlikely to significantly reduce the use of antibiotics in farm animals. And that's really at the crux of what we're talking about.
Right.
And that's because of the loophole we were talking about earlier. We think that loophole is a really big problem because it makes it appear as if progress is being made when it probably isn't. Delays the solution longer.
Mm-hmm.
And allows the problem of resistance to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
And these are really important medicines for human medicine. So that's why we don't think FDA is going far enough, and we think this doesn't really address the problem because it's not really going to reduce antibiotic use from our perspective.
Yeah, and I think that it's worth noting that at present, we really have no, and correct me if I'm wrong, Avi, because you probably know better than I do, but to my knowledge, there are no mechanisms by which we are able to calculate or measure the amount of antibiotics saved through the amount of pounds that are sold per year into a particular sector, in this case, the agricultural sector. I want to quickly move on to something that Dr. Scott Hurd, who's been a guest on my program before, he's a veterinarian from Iowa State University. He has come out saying, both in print and in private, that the reason that these guidances are a good idea as opposed to actual legislation is that if these measures were legislated into law, meaning that there was compliance was compulsory, that this would result in a number of lawsuits by pharmaceutical companies and by animal agricultural companies protesting these measures, and that the legislation would then be locked up in court for many years to come, and the problem would persist even longer than the 3 years that we're hoping will kind of more or less solve it. How do you respond to that?
I'm a little confused by it. I don't completely understand that. The industry is so willing to go along with FDA's recommendations to give up growth promotion use. Why would it fight binding rules requiring exactly the same thing?
I don't know, but that's that. He's not the only person who's had this position, which is that actually this is a great thing that these are voluntary guidelines rather than law, because then there won't be any, you know, problem with lawsuits locking up this legislation or locking up these measures any longer than necessary. So
right.
I think you make a good point. The NRDC has taken certain actions in terms of using antibiotics as growth promotants. These are in the sense of bills that are being legislated both in California and I hope nationally. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. So right now there are a couple of bills in the federal legislature. One is called the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act that's been introduced by Representative Slaughter. And there's a Senate bill, which is the Preventing Antibiotic Resistance Act, which was introduced by Senator Feinstein. And both of those bills would phase out the use of antibiotics in animals that are not sick. And I think those are important pieces of legislation. We support them. And here in California, there's a bill that was introduced by Assemblymember Mullen that's modeled on those bills at the federal level and would also require that for meat sold in California, the use of antibiotics in animals that are not sick be phased out. It would also require that for any meat sold in California, the use of antibiotics be reported to the state so that we can monitor and track the use and trends and where changes could be made.
And again, let's reiterate the fact that at the present time, there is no mechanism for tracking the use of antibiotics in livestock agriculture, correct?
Yeah, so what we don't have is use data. So mm-hmm. we don't know how it's being used, exactly where it's being used, exactly what purposes it's being used for. What we do know right now is basically sales data, as you mentioned. It's how much is being sold for animals and which classes of antibiotics can be sold for animals. So we know that penicillins, for instance, are sold at X 100,000 pounds, for instance, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. But we don't know whether they're used for growth promotion, for disease prevention, or for actual therapeutic treatment, correct?
No, we do not know that. And that's partly because mm-hmm. a lot of these drugs are approved for all three of those purposes. So.
Right.
Or at least a couple of them. So it's hard to separate out what is being used for when you look at sales data.
One thing that was interesting to me when I was looking over the NRDC website, I noticed, I think about a year ago, there was a press release that said that a lot of these drugs at this point in time would not have been approved. They were approved 20 or 30 years ago by FDA, but if they were brought up for approval now, they would not pass muster. Can you just describe that for just a second? Like, what does that mean, and how come they can, why can't we, you know, change that now?
Thanks. That's a really great question. We put out a report in January that looked at this issue, and basically FDA did a review in the 2000s of penicillins and tetracyclines that were approved many years ago,
mm-hmm.
decades ago, as a matter of fact. And it went back and looked at whether the use of these antibiotics in feed was shown to be safe. That is, whether it posed a risk to human health. What they concluded, they looked at 30 different penicillins and tetracyclines
mm-hmm.
that are used in animal feed, and they concluded that none of these antibiotics would likely be approved today if they were up for approval because there's not enough evidence showing that they are safe, as they're required to show.
Safe in the sense...
In fact...
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
In fact, about 18 of them they even concluded were high risk, and still they haven't done anything about it, and they're supposed to withdraw approval for drugs when they're not shown to be safe and effective. And, you know, we brought a lawsuit over this in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
In that lawsuit, we challenged FDA's failure to withdraw approval for penicillins and tetracyclines in animal feed. Even as far back as 1977, FDA had concluded these uses posed a risk to human health
mm-hmm.
and had proposed to withdraw approval for these drugs, but then just never followed through. So our lawsuit went to court to force them to act on those findings, and the district court agreed with us, the federal district court agreed with us, and ordered FDA to discontinue the uses of these particular antibiotics, penicillins and tetracyclines, in animal feed,
mm-hmm.
unless drug manufacturers showed that they were safe. There was a second part to the case I can tell you more about in a second, but basically FDA appealed that decision. We're awaiting a decision at the appeals court level at this point.
Amazing. So, I mean, in a way, it's sort of interesting to me that this goes through the legislative process, or excuse me, the courts, and a judge who theoretically is impartial does not see the validity of your position or does not but
actually,
doesn't support
did.
This. It did. Oh, so now
yes,
it's going
the
through court the
court agreed
of appeal.
With us.
Oh, so the
court
FDA is appealing this. Okay, thank you for clarifying that for me.
Sorry. No problem. Let me try that again just so I'm clear. The court agreed with us that when FDA found that the use of penicillins and tetracyclines in animal feed is not shown to be safe and that it poses a risk to human health, that once it made that finding, it was obligated to remove the approval for these antibiotics in animal feed, unless drug manufacturers showed in a hearing that they were actually safe, which we think they'll have a very, very hard time doing. And so basically the court agreed with us that, you know, FDA made this finding back in 1977 and should have acted on it and ordered them to act on it, but FDA has appealed that decision.
Incredible. How do you respond to the notion that the industry often repeats that using antibiotics is very expensive, that not all producers use this to, you know, prophylactically treat their animals, that antibiotics are judiciously used and so forth and so on? I mean, there are reams and reams of articles and editorials on the meat trade paper websites that people can look at that justify the use of antibiotics and also say that really there is no smoking gun. There is no specific study that proves incontrovertibly that antibiotic use in livestock leads to antibiotic resistance. How does NRDC respond to that? That's a two-pronged question
evidence.
There. I'm sorry, but
no, that's fine. So I think there's a couple of different things you asked. So let me start with whether this is a problem or not and the evidence for that.
Okay.
I think there's a lot of evidence that the use of antibiotics in animals is contributing to adverse health effects in humans.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're in very, very good company on this. I mean, the CDC has said that, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the World Health Organization has said that, the American Association of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association, the Infectious Diseases Society of America, the American Public Health Association. That could go on and on.
Unfortunately, the CDC did not actually point the finger at animal agriculture, which they were very quick to to praise the CDC for. And I've actually read the report, and it does not specifically say that animal agriculture is a primary culprit in the rise of multi-drug resistant pathogens. I thought that was unfortunate.
No, actually, they did say something, and they said that the use of antibiotics in animals is contributing to the problem, the antibiotic-resistant problems in humans. I think they acknowledged that. I don't think they put a percentage to it, but they did say it was part of the problem of antibiotic resistance.
Right.
I can find a quotation for you if you like in a little bit and come back to you on that.
Sure.
So, I mean, the CDC, the World Health Organization, all those medical institutions that are referred to, they've all said that the use of antibiotics in animals is contributing to the overall problem. There was a study last year in Pennsylvania that looked at, basically concluded that the closer you live to farms that were treated with swine manure or to swine facilities themselves, the more likely you were to be infected with antibiotic-resistant skin infections, including MRSA.
Right.
And there was a study earlier this year out of Iowa that looked at the levels of antibiotic-resistant bacteria carried by people, the colonization of people by antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And again, they found that people living closer to animal facilities, swine facilities, had higher levels of antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Fascinating. Because that's one of the big issues, is whether or not humans and animals trade bacteria. And that's been something that the industry has said, I could be wrong about this, but my understanding is that their position is that there's very little evidence supporting that humans and animals trade bacteria, and therefore the rise of antibiotic-resistant drug pathogens such as MRSA, which is Methicillin Staph aureus,
Methicillin-resistant
aureus, that this particular disease is really from hospitals, and that we've given it to pigs and not sort of vice versa, which I thought was an interesting position to take.
It's an interesting position, but here's how, I think if you look at the scientific literature, you'll find that that's not really the case. As I said, all these medical and scientific organizations are on one side of the issue, and the industry's on the other side. The Once resistant bacteria are generated on the farm, they can leave in a number of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
They can get out on in air, soil, and water, on workers, through meat. And also, actually, bacteria can share their resistance characteristics with other bacteria, with totally different species of bacteria. And this can happen in all these other mediums that we're talking about, including the human gut and the animal gut.
Right.
So to be able to say that this does not happen, I think that's I'd love to see proof of that.
Avi, we're going to take a short break right now do a sponsor drop, and then we'll be right back to talk more about antibiotic resistance and especially about these guidances and the drug companies that have agreed to voluntarily change their labels. So stay with us, folks.
Great.
Today's music is Leaving by Dead Stars on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
We're back. This is What Doesn't Kill You on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. On the phone with me is Avinash Kaur, who is an attorney with the National Resources Defense Council. And we're talking about antibiotics and the recent news that 25 out of 26 pharmaceutical companies supplying antibiotics to the livestock agriculture sector have agreed to change the labels on their drugs to essentially shut down, supposedly, the use of antibiotics as growth promotants. Now, yesterday, on Saturday, the NY Times published a really interesting editorial saying that this was great news. And then yesterday, an editorial came out in Drover's Cattle Network, one of my very favorite journals about the meat industry. It's written by industry insiders, and it's a really informative and interesting publication. The author, Chuck Jolly, is an industry expert and a spokesperson for the meat industry. He's been in the industry for many, many years. And some of the things that he said really struck me as, I don't know how to describe it. It was just like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Really, I really had that reaction. So let me start with, I'm going to quote it. It says, some fact-free hand-wringers see a rise in antibiotic-resistant bacteria and immediately demand that all such medicines be banned from agricultural use, and that we follow the European model, ban all non-therapeutic uses of antibiotics on food animals. They seem to love the doomsday scenario, gleefully spouting off reports about the worst of all possible worlds, the great black plague that nearly obliterated Europe in the 14th century. So, I mean, how do you respond when the industry is calling people like the NRGC, the Pew, the WHO as a hand wringer? I mean, what? You know, like, I mean, this is the propaganda that's going out to the cattle industry, the pork industry, the poultry industry, and these people are lapping it up.
I mean, I think the only thing we can do is point out that we're in some very good company. You know,
yeah.
I was talking about the CDC earlier. This is what they said. up to half of antibiotic use in humans, and much of antibiotic use in animals is unnecessary and inappropriate and makes everyone less safe.
Wow.
You know, there's a broad coalition of prominent medical and public health groups that said overuse and misuse of important antibiotics in food animals must end in order to protect human health. And the groups that were on this letter included the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Preventive Medicine, the American Medical Association, the American Public Health Association, and on and on.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're in some very good company.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I wanted to say one more thing about Chuck Jolly's note. He quotes Dr. Richard Raymond, who's also been a regular guest on this show. I like Dick Raymond a lot. He's really been a great mentor for me in some ways. He is the former USDA FSIS undersecretary, and he is currently a consultant to several pharmaceutical companies. And he dismisses this this concern about antibiotics is mostly stuff and nonsense. And then he is quoted as saying, "It remains to be seen if this action actually will decrease antibiotic resistance in pathogens affecting human health. It has not done so after 10 years of a similar ban in Denmark. And my personal belief is that this will not affect human health at all, but time will tell." So do you have any insight on what happened in Denmark, on the experiment in Denmark, and what the numbers have been in terms of multi-drug resistance pathogens either increasing or decreasing post-ban?
Sure. Denmark has seen a reduction in the presence of resistant bacteria in meat and in animals, and the levels of resistance in their meat is lower than on meat imported from other countries. However, Denmark, you know, the borders are not impermeable. You know, resistance still comes in from other places. Human use still contributes to resistance. And once you generate resistance, wherever it may be generated, it doesn't mean that it'll automatically go away. So the human use picture is a lot more complicated, but on meat and in animals, we can already see declines in the levels of resistance in Denmark. And, you know, there's an experiment from 1976, there's a paper that was published that showed that reducing the use of antibiotics in animals can make a difference. In that study, the scientists introduced antibiotics to a farm where antibiotics hadn't been used previously, and they found that as the antibiotics were introduced, the levels of resistance in the chicken and the workers who worked with the chicken went up.
Right.
And when they removed the antibiotics from the system over time, that resistance declined. Now, that's in a pretty controlled environment, relatively speaking, but, you know, it shows that it can make a difference. We're not adding to the burden of antibiotic-resistant bacteria out there, and I think Denmark is showing that that's also possible. You know, overall, I think it's misleading for Dr. Raymond to suggest that antibiotic use in animals does not affect human health. As I was saying before, there's very broad agreement in the scientific and medical community that animal use of antibiotics is contributing to the rise of resistance, and that resistance threatens human health. Including especially these last two papers I mentioned, one in Pennsylvania showing that the closer you live to swine facilities and farms treated with swine manure, the more likely you are to be infected with antibiotic-resistant skin infections, including MRSA.
Which is, by the way, quite terrifying. It's really, really scary and very, very hard to treat. I mean, really hard to get rid of. I mean, and it used to be in hospitals, it was a fatal thing. I mean, if you got MRSA, you were dead meat. I mean, now I guess they've figured out how to treat the skin infections, which are slightly different from having the systemic infection. I'm not quite sure how that works. But anyway, back to this interesting editorial by Mr. Jolly, who I was hoping would call in today, but apparently he was in meetings and unable to join us. But he says that the inference, of course, is that the core problem is human usage, not animal usage. That's in reference to the CDC report that you just quoted. And he's saying that Mama might insist that little Junior be prescribed a useless Z-Pack for his viral-caused sniffles, but a penny-pinching rancher will never dose his cattle with expensive antibiotics unless it's absolutely necessary for disease control. But that's absolutely not true, right? I mean, that's why I was going down. I was referring to that earlier with Dr. Hurd, who said the same thing. Oh, they're never going to waste their money on antibiotics that they don't absolutely need. And yet, I mean, I guess if you need to turn a profit, then you need to use antibiotics, right? Because the profit margins are pretty small in
I don't think
animals.
That's necessarily true either. I think, you know, you don't need antibiotics. And the people who are showing it all the time, you know, there are producers in the U.S. who are producing meat without the use of antibiotics. And in Denmark, there's an entire industry that's removed the use of antibiotics on animals that are not sick. And they're producing more animals than before. While
yes.
You know, they reduced use by about 50%.
Yep.
They've increased production by about 12%. It hasn't affected food prices. It hasn't made food less safe. In fact, you know, they've reduced resistance in meat and animals. So, and they've done all this without the any major impact on the industry. I think the WHO, the World Health Organization, estimated the cost might have gone up by about 1% in switching practices. So the industry seems to be doing just fine. And the kind of things they're doing are not rocket science. We're talking about things like better cleaning, a little more space for animals, weaning the animals later, vaccinations.
Right.
I mean, these are things that are better management practices.
Yeah. I mean, even Dr. Hurd, when he and I and Emily Meredith from the Animal Agriculture Alliance wrote an a blog post for the Huffington Post together, and I said, what would you do if you didn't have antibiotics? He said, better sanitation, probiotics, and vaccinations. Boom. Done. Problem
yep.
solved. So,
and then that one thing to note about that
mm-hmm.
is that the Danish system is not like a pasture-based system. It's the industrial system of rearing animals.
That's right.
And they've managed to eliminate the use of antibiotics in animals that are not sick and are thriving.
Yes.
So it can be done here, too.
It can be done here. And, you know, the question has to be asked is, like, why is the industry fighting tooth and nail to hang on to this when, in fact, consumer interest and consumer concerns are really driving a very strong message to them, which is that we don't want to buy that kind of meat anymore. You know, like, people are getting the message, and in my opinion, if I were a meat producer, I'd be going over to the antibiotic-free model right away and charging a premium for it because people are willing to pay.
I think more and more meat is showing up as antibiotic-free or raised without antibiotics in the market. And that's a good thing. And I think, you know, if consumers continue to demand meat produced without antibiotics, we're going to see more and more movement in that direction. But that won't solve the entire problem. In the market can't address all of the uses that are problematic, just as the organic label can't deal with all the problems that are out there in agriculture.
Right.
So I think, you know, consumers are definitely a part of the problem, and we need to keep asking for better produced meat and holding companies to higher standards. But we also need laws and regulations that really require the prudent use and ensure the prudent use of antibiotics so that we're not squandering them for slightly cheaper meat that is produced on facilities that are not taking the kind of better management practices that they should be.
You bring up the interesting and excellent point about prudent and judicious use, which is something that the meat industry touts a lot, and they actually have on some of their websites, like the American the Animal Health Institute has a definition of judicious use, which I thought was really interesting and very comprehensive. And the thing is that these guidances also call for, we didn't really explain what they are ultimately, but one of the guidances calls for the fact that a vet must be writing prescriptions for the use of antibiotics on farm, and that is part of the whole judicious use aspect of this. And one of
right.
the things that, when I was researching for this program, I looked on the FDA website, and I found that, and this is something, again, that Scott Hurd mentioned, there are hardly any large animal vets. So if there are hardly any large animal vets, and we have literally billions of animals in confinement who have up till now been routinely treated with antibiotics, how are we going to practice oversight of so-called judicious use? And how are these vets going to be able to write those prescriptions? How will farmers be able to get those prescriptions? I mean, just to give you a quote from the FDA website, there are counties in the U.S. where there are greater than 25,000 food animals and no food animal veterinarians. These areas are most common in the central U.S. I mean, who's going to be writing the scripts, and how are we going to be able to regulate that?
Thanks, Katie. Thank you for bringing us back to the guidance. As you said, the guidance does two things, just because you had said, you know, we didn't finish the discussion on those. One is it encourages companies to give up growth promotion labels, as you mentioned. The other is that continues the allowed the continuing use of antibiotics for so-called disease prevention purposes, as long as the vets are involved. And as you said, there's a shortage of vets. But if we stop using antibiotics for preventive purposes, which we think is an inappropriate use, FDA explicitly acknowledges these animals are not sick.
Mm-hmm.
Then if we stop using, and then this we understand to be the majority of the use in animals, then there'll be a lot less burden on veterinarians to dispense antibiotics for animals. And the fewer, with the lesser demand, the veterinarians that are there will be better able to respond to the problem. That doesn't mean they'll be able to respond to the shortage completely. But we need to, you know, in addition to that, we need to have incentives in place to encourage more veterinary students to go into the field and to serve in the community where there is greatest need. But we can start by making sure we're not roping vets into dealing with preventive uses which are not necessary.
Absolutely. I mean, this is just, this is such a sort of manifold and complex problem because of the way we have allowed animal husbandry to evolve in this country in terms of creating these, you know, I know they hate to use the word factory farm, but intensive farming, intensive farming operations or confined area feeding operations. I mean, it's like you sort of almost really can't unpack one thing without discovering a whole Pandora's box of other problems. And to me, the shortage of veterinarians who deal with large animals or food animals is just one of the many manifold problems that the industry has to address and deal with. And it's, you know, it'll be interesting to see how they manage this. I wanted to go back to something that you mentioned about foster farms being, because we only have a few minutes left, you and many other people wrote a letter to foster farms because of their supposed attitude towards antibiotics and asked them to be a leader. Can you just talk for a second about that and sort of extrapolate that to larger companies like, say, Cargill or Tyson?
Sure. You know, last year there was a Salmonella outbreak that many people heard about, made
Absolutely.
A lot of people sick.
Yep.
That salmonella was found to be drug resistant and may have contributed to some of the increased levels of hospitalizations that were seen.
Yes.
You know, foster farms has not told us how they use antibiotics, and they have not committed to using these antibiotics in a way that does not promote antibiotic resistance. And this letter that went from about 30-plus organizations to foster farms asked them to do a couple of things. It asked them to both disclose the antibiotic use practices and to commit to better antibiotic stewardship so that they're using antibiotics only in animals that are not sick or to control disease outbreaks in limited circumstances.
I mean, only animals that are sick.
On the premises.
Right, right, right. Only animals that are sick, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Have they responded to that?
That's what we're asking them to do, and I think the industry needs to turn in that direction. We've got examples both here and abroad. You know, Chipotle is a large company that's selling meat all around the country, and all their meat is, I think almost all their meat is produced without the use of antibiotics.
All except the beef. They cannot supply enough beef. There
right,
is not enough
right.
beef for them to use antibiotic-free beef.
So, I mean, there's an opportunity there for somebody, except, you
I think
know.
So.
But basically, you know, there's more and more efforts to consumers turning to meat raised without antibiotics, and we've got lots of examples of people doing it. Now we need more people to commit to making those practices a reality.
And so we just have a couple minutes left, so I want you to just mention to people again the names of those pieces of legislation, PAMPTA, DATA, which was introduced by by Henry Waxman, and what was the third one, Dianne Feinstein's bill?
It's PARA, Preventing Antibiotic Resistance Act.
Right. So people should check in. I mean, we do have the power. Let's face it. I mean, you can vote with your dollars, and you can vote with your vote. And the more you write into local legislation, local legislators, or support organizations like the NRDC, right, the more you can turn this boat around. Tell us a little bit about the website. Where can people access more information here?
You can go to www.nrdc.org, and that's NRDC's website, and you can find more information about our work there.
Absolutely. I urge people to do this. I mean, this is literally the public health crisis of our age. And I've been reporting on this for 4 years now, people. And finally, the mainstream media has caught up to it. And I'm really hoping to see, and it's encouraging to see that the industry, despite their kicking and screaming, is you know, slowly coming around to it. So it's really a matter of just demanding from your grocery stores, I want more choices in antibiotic-free products, and talking to your legislators and telling them that you want them to vote that way. And maybe in the next couple of years, before this 3-year trial period elapses, we can make some changes in the way that we do business in this country. One of the things that really upsets me about the meat industry is they consistently say that we are trying to shut them down. Is that... In the last moment of this program, Avi, can you tell me, is the NRDC looking to end the meat industry as we know it now?
Not at all. You know, I personally eat meat. I just look for meat raised without antibiotics. And, you know, the idea is to improve the way we produce meat so that we're not squandering the effectiveness of these essential and life-saving medicines. And we look to examples like Denmark, where they have done it, where they've done it with an intensive system of agriculture, and it's with better management practices. That's what we want to see.
That's right. So thanks so much for your time today, Avi. I really enjoyed it. I hope you'll come back. I know we're going to be talking again, maybe not with you, but with another colleague about the economics of taking antibiotics out of the food system. That'll be coming up sometime in July, I think, when your paper is published. Is that what I heard?
I think that's right.
Yeah, and you and I will be in constant contact so that you can tell me
what's
going on.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You betcha. Thank you. And thanks to my sponsor, Tabard Inn, and thanks to my engineer. And we'll see you next week with another episode of What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights with me, Katie Kiefer. So long for now, folks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.